Hello, this is Mary Rose Cottingham with the Decatur Herald Review, dated Thursday, June 11th, 2015. We will begin today's reading on the front page with an article headline, Rahner Stays on Offense, in Decatur Stop. And this was written by staff writer Ryan Voiles. Governor Bruce Rahner did not mince words Wednesday afternoon as he sought public support in his showdown with state lawmakers. The history and the trajectory of our state is on the line this summer, he said. With Lake Decatur as his backdrop, the Winnetka Republican launched into a 15-minute speech to rally support from local political and business leaders against what he called the Chicago machine of House Speaker Michael Madigan and Senate President John Cullerton, Chicago Democrats who have not gone along with Rahner's requests. Rahner continuously hammered on the point that residents of Decatur need to call their local lawmakers and demand to know where they stand on negotiations. Do they stand with the Chicago machine that's driven us in the ditch for the last 12 years, Rahner said, or do they support the people of Illinois? That point, which he has repeated at multiple stops in the past week, was a not-so-subtle reference to State Representative Sue Schreurer, Democrat from Decatur, and State Senator Andy Mayner, Democrat from Bunker Hill, whose districts include Decatur. Both have recently been targeted by the Rahner administration as under the control of Chicago Democrats. As several in the crowd began to jeer the governor for potential cuts to state services, the governor noted his office has tried to make concessions to Democrats in the House, but said he's focused on the passage of five pieces of reform in return for the passage of a budget before it ends June 30th. Those included items he has spent 9 months discussing, from the need to lower property taxes, scale back workers' compensation expenses, institute tort reform, and have term limits for lawmakers. They're stonewalling us, Rahner said about Democrats in Springfield. They're pretending that they're negotiating, and they're not. He has also rejected the notion that he was moving too fast and trying to pass too many reforms at one time. Illinois deserves a lot. The people deserve a lot, Rahner said. Though he noted that he would consider a tax hike, Rahner said it would be instituted in connection with his turnaround agenda of targeted tax cuts, legal reforms, and business-friendly policy changes. Similar to his recent stops across southern and western Illinois this week, the governor was met with some protesters who asked about potentially devastating cuts to child care and home care services. The mood after Rahner's speech was tense, with protesters and attendees yelling at one another over the necessity of cutting the child care assistance program. Annie Yarberry, a child care worker from Decatur, asked the governor why he could not just come together with Madigan and Cullerton and make some decisions for the betterment of the state. We need you, Madigan and Cullerton, to get it together and stop fighting like two-year-olds and stand up for the people of Illinois, Yarberry said. Rahner talked to Yarberry after his speech and said he appreciated and understood her concerns, but said she needed her talk to local lawmakers and tell them to support him in the middle class. With Madigan and Cullerton, who have caused the crisis and these cuts to have happen, ask your local lawmakers if they'll stand with them or with a change in direction, Rahner said. Our next article, also from the front page, is headlined, Decatur Public Library Unveils Local History Room, written by Allison Petty. After years languishing in obscurity, local history materials collected by the Decatur Public Library finally have room to breathe. The library's new local history room, spanning about 4,000 feet on the first floor, took about 6 months to build. It is much larger and more visible than the Schilling Local History Room. Items and boxes formerly relegated to a closet are spread neatly on shelves to await processing by archivist Becky Damps. We've got all kinds of stuff that's going to finally see the light of day, she said. Take, for example, the annual report books of the Ladies' Library Association, which was the predecessor to the Decatur Public Library. Damps said library staff had a vague knowledge of the records from 1868 to 1874, but they were buried. Now, materials such as those will be kept in a storage and work area that is not accessible to the public, so damps will be able to spread them out on a new processing table and organize them in a way that makes sense. Once processed, the collections are generally available by request. Other materials, such as framed pictures and exhibits, will be displayed on a rotating basis in the reading area, where patrons and visitors can do their research. Scenes from the library's history are currently on display. An 1833 map of the United States will remain a permanent fixture, Damp said. The reading area houses a desk for volunteers, 4 tables, a microfilm machine, 3 computers, collections of obituaries, and shelves full of reference books and yearbooks. The library will hold an open house in the new space from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, with ribbon cutting at 1:15 p.m. Refreshments will be served in the lobby. The project has been in the making for more than 8 years. The Decatur Public Library Foundation raised more than $600,000 in donations in 2006 and 2007, including money from the Friends of the Decatur Public Library. Plans for the space changed several times. Officials initially envisioned using a vacant area on the library's second floor. Later, they planned to renovate the first floor of the library annex building. In the end, these projects exceeded the available budget. The library board approved plans for the smaller expansion last year, with construction beginning in October. Of all the library's assets, the local history space is most likely to attract users who are not from Decatur. People come from all over the country, Damp said. They also call us from all over the country, email us from all over the country. So that's why it's important to have this extra room in here and the computers available, the microfilm available, so that when they come in, they can do what they need to do. Our next article, also written by Allison Petty, is headlined Coalition Plans Fun-Filled Summer in Mueller Park. When Jeffrey Perkins was growing up, Mueller Park came alive during the warm months, teeming with kids playing baseball and taking part in events. These days, he said, the same crowds aren't there, but a unique partnership between Caring Black Men, of which Perkins is the founder, the Decatur Park District, and the Macon County Sheriff's Office aims to change that. The three groups are teaming up this summer for a pilot program offering free activities in the park, including clinics for baseball, basketball, soccer, and golf. The park will also host 2 free movie nights, and Caring Black Men will lead character-building discussions with the young men who attend the Thursday events. For this end of town, the south end of town, we thought it might be a way of trying to bring more people back to the parks to keep the kids off the street, Perkins said. Representatives from all 3 organizations gathered Tuesday for a kickoff event at the park, where they served hot dogs, chips, and drinks. The park is also one of the district's sites for free lunches for anyone younger than 18, served between 1 to 2 p.m., and evening activities led by park leaders from 5:30 to 8 p.m. on weekdays. Equipment for the clinics come either from the park district's supplies or purchased by a donation from the sheriff's office. The park district's soccer coaching staff will direct the clinic. The Par Timers Golf Club will handle the golf clinic. Volunteers will direct the baseball clinic. And Eisenhower High School coach Rodney Walker will help with the basketball clinic. All of the events are open to all children and families, regardless of whether they live in the south end of town. Perkins said children of any age are welcome at the clinics, through 7 to 12, though 7 to 12 would be the target age range. Lieutenant Tony Brown said Macon County Sheriff's deputies will be in the park throughout the program in hopes of developing good relationships with youth. Just because we wear a uniform or a badge, we're people and we care about them, and that's what this is all about, Brown said. The sheriff's office donated $6,795 for the kickoff event, equipment and movie rights, and $14,500 for improvements to the park's restrooms and staging area. Our next article from the front page is headlined, Macon County High Schools Receive CPR Training Kits Through Donation, and is written by Emily Steele. Area students will have a gift waiting for them after summer break, when a new state law kicks in requiring high schools to teach CPR. All of Macon County's high schools received CPR in-school training kits thanks to a private donation entrusted to the American Heart Association. With our school district struggling financially, it is difficult for them to find the funds needed to purchase CPR training materials, said Jill Reedy, Assistant Regional Superintendent for the Macon-Piatt Regional Office of Education. We greatly appreciate the support of the American Heart Association. Former Governor Pat Quinn signed Lauren's Law last June, requiring all high school students to be trained in recognizing when and how to use CPR and AED, Automated External Defibrillator. Schools were left scrambling to figure out how to fit one more skill into already busy schedules and how to fund it. Last week, representatives from area schools picked up the large red duffel bags holding the kits at a press conference. The donation was large enough for each high school to have two. The portable bags were designed by the Heart Association specifically to train students' core CPR skills in under 30 minutes. Usually, a certification class can take as long as 3 hours. The reusable kits contain 10 inflatable mannequins and an instructional DVD. They can train up to 20 students at once on hands-only CPR or CPR with rescue breaths. Tony Crystal called up 4 people from each school district to practice chest compressions on the mannequins. A staff member, Richland Community College's Health Professions Office, he told them chest compressions can greatly improve someone's chances of survival during a cardiac arrest. "That's what you're going to be teaching your students how to do," Crystal said, "to help save a life." With her son Mike by her side, Lisa Smith spoke about how he went into a cardiac arrest last July while playing in their neighborhood. A bystander did CPR, and he later had surgery to repair a heart defect. "I just want people to know our story and know cardiac arrest can happen at any time," Smith said. "Because of CPR training, your students will save lives." The normally quiet Mike Smith, age 11, would have rather been playing video games or basketball, but spoke up at the press conference. "I'm glad I'll have the opportunity to learn CPR in high school," Mike said. Lauren's Law requires all Illinois high schools to provide CPR training through health classes starting in the 2014-15 school year. Some, but not all, schools already taught the skill. The law is named for Lauren Lehman, a high school senior who went into cardiac arrest during dance practice in 2008. CPR was not performed, and an available AED was not used. While cardiac arrest is a leading cause of death in the U.S., 70% of Americans feel unable to help because they don't know CPR or fear hurting the victim, according to the Heart Association. Immediate CPR can double or triple a victim's chances of survival. Our next article from the front page, headlined "Macon County Fair Opens on Optimistic Note," and is written by Ryan Voiles. While his 2-year-old daughter wanted to ride the carousel Tuesday evening, Russ Anderson did not expect that he would be the one she wanted to ride on. As the horses spun in the never-ending circle without riders, Anderson held his daughter through the duration of the ride. "At least she seemed to have fun spinning around there," he said with a smile. Anderson was among the hundreds that turned up Tuesday night at the kickoff of the 2015 Macon County Fair, a week-long event that will feature carnival rides, rodeos, and a wide variety of vendors. While events are scheduled throughout the week, Tuesday night simply featured carnival rides with staples such as the Ferris wheel and bumper cars open for business. "The carnival night was considered a soft opening for the fair," said Teresa McMillans, the Macon County Fair Board Treasurer. "It was intended to raise awareness for the start of the fair and to provide an affordable way for families to experience it. Right now, we're just gearing up for the busier days," she said. Though the late afternoon heat forced some to head into the shade, others said it was nice to have the event come back and provide some family entertainment. "It's nice to come out here and bring the family, give the kids a chance to have fun with some of the rides and games," said DeAndre Russell. "It was a marked difference from last year, when cold weather and rain started the events at the fairground on a dour note. While fewer than 300 people came to the fairground the entirety of the opening night last year, McWilliams said they had already passed that number within the first 2 hours of the fair opening Tuesday night. "It's another positive step for the fair, which just a few years ago was on the verge of bankruptcy with a nearly $300,000 deficit. That number has been whittled down to $130,000, which fair officials are hopeful can be paid off by the event next year. Fair events continue today with a 4-H poultry show, photography critiques, and go-kart races. Admission for the fair is $1 and parking is free. For more information, see www.maconcountyfair.com. Our next HART article is headlined, Camp Discovery Takes Aim at Summer Learning, written by Valerie Wells. Wednesday was a day of firsts for Kendra Hentz. She had never before used a bow and arrow. She had never been in a canoe. She and the rest of the Camp Discovery students did both at Rock Springs Conservation Area. Laughingly admitting that she's a fan of the Hunger Games with heroine Katniss, a master of the bow and arrow, Kendra said she enjoyed trying out archery. I hit my target 2 out of 3 times, she said. I'm pretty scared about canoeing, but I'm going to do it anyway. The general theme at Decatur School's summer programs is project-based learning, presenting students with a problem to solve and letting them have at it. The idea is to put their learning in their own hands and spark their creativity. I know this has nothing to do with project-based learning, said Angie Brills, who teaches at Stephen Decatur Middle School during the school year, but it's team building, and they're doing something they've never done before. The camp is also supposed to be about having fun, spending time outdoors, and making new friends, she said. Counselors include one adult, one college student, and one high school student per group, and Bryles was pleased to find that her high school student counselor is also her former student, Sydney Wilson, from Stephen Decatur. Some of the middle school students were reluctant to try canoeing, expressing fears of getting dirty or wet or encountering snakes and turtles. Wilson, a MacArthur High School student, encouraged them. This is so fun, she said, settling into a canoe and grabbing a paddle like an old pro. Her enthusiasm convinced the younger students to make their wobbly way into canoes, with Rock Springs Program Services Director Jeff Tisch instructing them on how to board, paddle, and disembark. Rachel Klaus has been in boats before and even driven a motorboat, but this was her first time in a canoe, while fellow camper Kandri Kogan had never been in any kind of a boat. I do this almost every weekend, said Hannah Jaggers, who normally attends Johns Hill Magnet School. Usually we rent a canoe, but sometimes we go rafting instead. Our next article is written by Kurt Erickson, headlined, Comptroller Says State Money Spigot Won't Go Dry on July 1st. Governor Bruce Rauner's hand-picked comptroller says a failure to get a state budget in place would leave her unable to pay many of the state's bills beginning July 1st. But Republican Leslie Munger acknowledged Wednesday that the state's money spigot would not completely shut off in 3 weeks if an impasse continues between her political patron and Democrats who control the legislature. In a press conference in Chicago, Munger said she will still be able to write checks to cover the state's debt, pension payments, and retiree benefits. Payments to needy families and aid for some programs serving seniors and the disabled also will continue to flow, as well as state payments to local governments. And lawmakers will continue to be paid as part of a court ruling that says their salaries cannot be reduced during their current terms. Munger said she'd prefer not to pay lawmakers if they can't get a budget in place. If I could make the decision on my own, I would not pay them, Munger said. If a budget is not in place when the fiscal year ends on June 30th, Munger said she will not be able to reimburse Medicaid providers and state vendors, even though the immediate effect of the lack of money may not be apparent because those payments already are issued on a delayed basis. Not-for-profit agencies and small employees will be able to receive expedited payments, she said. And the first round of state employees affected by the standoff will begin missing paychecks on July 15th. We'll be asking them to come to work with no idea when we'll be able to pay them, Munger said. Although it is Munger's first time dealing with the lack of a budget, it is not unprecedented to start the fiscal year without a spending plan in place. In 2008, then-Comptroller Dan Hines said about 4,900 state employees would not get their mid-month paychecks if a budget was approved by July 10th. In addition to the possibility of missed payrolls, Hines also said the lack of an operating budget also would bar him from distributing checks to school districts, hospitals, and nursing home operators. Similar impasses between the legislature and former Governor Rod Blagojevich temporarily left the state without a budget in 2004 and 2007. Rakesha Phelan, spokeswoman for the Senate President John Cullerton, said the Chicago Democrat is hopeful a deal can be crafted, but expressed concern that Rauner may be trying to create a crisis in order to win support for his pro-business agenda. The General Assembly passed a budget, and there is still time to work with the governor on a final product if he isn't hell-bent on a shutdown, Phelan said. Other state elected officials say they are reviewing their options when it comes to the possibility of starting a new fiscal year without a spending plan in place. The situation is fluid and it could change every day, said Harry Haupt, spokesman for Secretary of State Jesse White. Munger, who was appointed to her post by Rauner following the death of former Comptroller Judy Barr Dupinca, said Democrats have been engaging in needless theater and should instead focus on reaching an accord with Rauner. I am here to remind all involved that this is not a game to be won or lost. Their rhetoric, posturing, and decisions have grave implications on people and communities across the state, Munger added. Our next article is written by Tony Reed and headlined, Caterpillar Shareholders Tepidly Approve of Executive Pay. Critics of the wages and bonuses Caterpillar Incorporated dishes out to its executives hailed the results of a shareholder vote Wednesday, which they claim will pressure the company to rethink top pay scales that are too generous. Caterpillar stockholders at their annual meeting in Wamego, Kansas, actually voted by 66% in an advisory-only vote to approve the executive compensation packages. But the history of such votes, known as Say on Pay and mandated by the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Law of 2010, indicate an approval vote of less than 70% is deemed a strong signal of investor unhappiness. Previous Say on Pay votes at Caterpillar have sailed through on 96% approval margins. This vote is a significant rebuke, said Michael Price Jones, a prominent critic of Caterpillar's top pay formula. Price Jones is Director of Corporate Governance at CTW Investment Group, which works with pension funds sponsored by Change to Win, a federation of unions representing more than 6 million members. What they, Caterpillar's Board of Directors, need to do is to go back to the drawing board, added Price Jones. They need better advice, better oversight. The compensation package of Doug Oberheimen, Caterpillar's Chairman and CEO, has been the source of much criticism. His mix of salary, incentive pay, stock awards, and pension payments totaled more than $17 million in 2014, including one bonus that maxed out at $4 million. Caterpillar recently recast the metrics used for calculating its executive bonuses, switching to a system linked to earnings per share. This has been criticized as lowering the performance bar because it can be influenced by stock buyback schemes, which inflate the share price. Caterpillar spent $4.2 billion on stock buybacks in 2014 and is grappling with its third straight year of sales declines. Caterpillar stated before Wednesday's shareholder vote that while not bound by the result, it would take careful note of it. The board values the opinions of company stockholders and, to the extent there is any significant vote against the named executive officer compensation, we will consider those stockholders' concerns, it said in a statement. The company says it will then evaluate whether any actions are necessary to address those concerns. Caterpillar also announced Wednesday it was upping its quarterly cash dividend by 10% to 77 cents per share, payable August 20th. Caterpillar shares finished Wednesday at $88.48, up $1.75 or up 2.02%. Our next article is headlined, Decatur Township Cuts $100,000 from General Assistance, written by Brian Voiles. The Decatur Township Board will now wait to see what happens after it cut nearly $100,000 out of its general assistance fund for the upcoming fiscal year. The board unanimously approved an amended budget that removed roughly $58,000 out of the funds that cover employee salaries and insurance, and $40,000 that would otherwise go toward transitional assistance. It also reduced the amount available for car mileage for employees from $1,000 to $500. The overall budget for the General Assistance Fund for the next budget year, which begins July 1st, will be about $544,800. That is well below the $643,883 originally budgeted and below the $563,212 budgeted for this fiscal year. Supervisor Lisa Stanley said after the meeting that things could not continue as is in the department. "We had to make some changes," she said. With the changes now approved, it remains to be seen what will happen with the three employees of the General Assistance Office, who are represented by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union. The employees also have a contract with the township that goes to April 2016. Stanley said they were set to meet with the union next week. General assistance, which aids those who do not qualify for other public assistance, has been a topic of heated discussion for several months, as the township's Board of Trustees has discussed ways to lower the amount of money going toward administration and provide more for residents, especially as the amount of money from local property taxes dries up. Before the final vote, several board trustees took the opportunity to express what they saw as a need to control costs in general assistance, whether that meant layoffs or changing an employee to part-time work. "I realize that we have a union contract and that we have to fulfill it," said Trustee Susan Gant Reynolds. With a potential new program, it may work out that we won't need as many people. No one likes to lay off people, but we need to get this under control," she said. The reduction in the amount for transitional assistance came as the board said the number of clients for the program has remained level at about 220, which did not necessitate the $100,000 increase in the grant from this year's budget. Our next article is headlined, "Bloomington Normal Area Copes with Flooding," written by Derek Bai. Twin Cities residents continued to cope with flood conditions Monday after storms dropped more than 3 inches of rain on Bloomington Normal on Sunday evening, and more rain and hail fell Monday. The city of Bloomington was still pumping water Monday evening to clear a section of Heartland Drive from Hershey Road to Cooper Court that flooded after storms started hitting around 4:30 p.m. on Sunday. A flash flood warning for most of the area expired at 6 a.m. Monday, but flooding stretched along a 1.5-block area on Heartland and continued east into a retention basin that, as of Monday morning, had about 9 feet of water in it. The city had 3 pumps running in the retention basin. "We'll be pumping out until at least today because we need to drain the water to find out what's plugging the basin," City Engineer Kevin Koth said. "The water is not near as high as it was." Water also covered a large parking lot, cutting off a business complex at 303 Hershey Road that houses Hewlett-Packard, Johnson Contractors, Advocate Medical Group, and Kelly Services. Cross said Monday afternoon that had been cleared. In the meantime, the City Engineering Department shuttled employees from the nearby Heartland Bank parking lot to the business complex. "It has not hurt our business at all. Most of the people coming in and out all drive trucks," said Johnson Contractors President Bill Johnston. "City employees are doing a great job helping everyone." Kevin Coslin, Director of Public Affairs for Advocate Broman Medical Group, said, "It's pretty much business as usual for us. The Hershey Road location houses 5 employees who work with patients for behavioral health." The latest forecast Monday evening showed no chance of rain on Tuesday, but a 30% chance Wednesday and Thursday, along with temperatures near 90 degrees. Thunderstorms and lower temperatures are likely on Friday. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald Review. Please stay tuned.